This is episode 53 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Brad Moss and the legal issues surrounding Donald J. Trump.
Folks, Neil Dewing here to tell you about our friends at Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small how-did-they-do-that-size box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. Its supportive memory foam offers a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and over 4.8 out of 5 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns to the US and Canada with a 100-night home trial. That's 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Now, a special offer for our listeners. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/fifth and using fifth as your promo code. That's www.casper.com/fifth, promo code fifth.
All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Jay, it's 90 degrees outside. I am cranky and I am tired.
Oh, okay.
That's how
great.
I'm doing.
Great. So you're doing well then.
This is the high point of my day.
Okay. All right.
And well, I hope it'll be the high point of our listeners' day as well. Because folks, we try to give you a moment of reflection, illumination, something that where you'll learn. And we hope that we're doing a good job with that. And if we are, we hope you'll consider going to iTunes and giving us a 5-star rating. And why do we hope that, Jay?
Because it strokes Neil's ego, for one.
Primarily, yes.
Yes, primarily. And number two is it when we have higher ratings and reviews, it kind of keeps us in front of people at iTunes, and we expand our audience so more people can hear us, and you know, we can get bigger guests and important people, that kind of thing. So we just love it anyway. We just like seeing that. So and you know, the thing is that this episode, if you're listening, we are at 97 star ratings. We want to get over 100. So go out there and do that, and then leave us a review as well. So Neil, lots of stuff going on. You know, it's still hard to believe that we're only about 5 months into the Trump administration, and now there's some big legal issues surrounding the president, and thanks to Jim Comey with his testimony and Robert Mueller being the special counsel who's been appointed, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on and people are arguing back and forth over a lot of legal issues that most people don't really comprehend or understand.
No, I think that, yeah, not a lot of people do have a firm grasp on what, say, the grounds for impeachment are. In actual fact, and actually, a piece of news that I just saw is that it was announced that the president is indeed now under investigation for possible obstruction of justice.
Right. And that's another thing. Like, what constitutes obstruction of justice? So that's,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
So these kinds of legal issues and you know, and a lot of people are, another thing we'll discuss, a lot of people are accusing Robert Mueller of having a conflict of interest in being Jim Comey's friend, so that he shouldn't be the special prosecutor. And people are actually advocating that Donald Trump fire him because of this relationship. So in order to do that, to really kind of get into that, we figured the best thing to do is have an attorney on as a guest. And so Brad Moss is here. He's an attorney. He's with the, how do you say Mark's last name, Brad?
Zaid.
Okay, so you're a partner in the, it, what is it? The, it's the...
It's the law office of Mark S. Zaid.
There
you really
go.
Have to change the title of the firm and make it into something more snazzy.
Yeah, and you got to have like, you guys are like on TV and stuff now. You know, you guys need to have something that's, you know, you could say from Super Zaid, the law firm of Super Zaid or something like that. But Brad, Brad Moss is here. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time to talk about these issues.
Absolutely. Not a problem to do so, guys.
So Brad, before we get started, before we get into that, go ahead and if you want, just go ahead and give our audience a background on what you do, what kind of law you practice, and that kind of thing.
Sure. So we handle what is essentially a rather niche area of employment law here inside the Beltway. Basically, all manner of people who work inside the intelligence community and for the federal government, whether it be civilian employees, government contractors, military officials, we represent them in any number of personnel actions and security clearance actions. So when people get in trouble, when they get something stupid and they're at risk of losing their job or their security clearance, we're one of the about maybe a dozen or 15 lawyers inside this town who handle this on a regular basis. So it's, you know, thinking CIA, DIA, FBI, every agency you can think of that's within the intelligence community, we've handled representation of an individual for one of those agencies. In addition to that, we also have what I consider the supplement to it is we do a lot of work that involves the media and transparency issues, particularly whether it's through the Freedom of Information Act in terms of representing various media outlets. We're now representing, I want to say, at least a good 7 or 8 different media outlets in any number of FOIA lawsuits for disclosure of records from any number of agencies, as well as helping former officials within the intelligence community get their books cleared. What a lot of people don't necessarily know is that if you've held a security clearance and you leave the federal government and you want to write your memoirs, there's actually a process you have to go through called pre-publication review to get that book cleared so that the government can't come after you afterwards, either criminally or civilly, in terms of coming after any proceeds you might get from a book to prevent them from coming after you. You have to go through this process and you have to make sure everything's clear and there's nothing classified in your book. So those are basically any number of issues that we handle for people. The large majority of our clients are average, ordinary, rank and file individuals within the federal government. We're not, you know, we don't typically end up handling the ones of the high level, you know, James Comey, David Petraeus. They tend to go to the larger, fancier firms. But we handle, I want to say, more of the, you know, the meat and potatoes, the very essence of who works for the federal government and any number of issues they'll run across.
Okay. Interesting. So that, all right. So that, you know, that encompasses a lot. So then I, you know, I would suspect that, you know, with, especially considering that, you know, you're defending a lot of this and you do it, you work with national security. So it's perfect that we have you on here. So, let's dive in first with Jim Comey's testimony, before the Senate Intelligence Committee last week. After he was done, you know, in my opinion, there were people who were laughably saying that, you know, Donald Trump came out looking better after Comey's testimony. And I said, and anybody who saw that, as far as I'm concerned, they were just reading Trump's tweets where he said he was vindicated, but that Jim Comey did nothing but lie, which is kind of interesting. But there were two issues that were brought up, and one, and Neil's going to ask about one, but the one of the deals is The Federalist had a piece on this, and I think even Jonathan Turley might have said something about this, that the memos that Jim Comey released. Now, there's a couple of things. Number one, I don't know if he actually released the actual memos. In his testimony, he said the content of the memos. But did he violate his FBI employment agreement by releasing any of that information? In your opinion, is there any kind of merit to that accusation?
Yeah, this has been brought up a lot. It was an immediate point raised in the aftermath of the testimony by the former director. And I actually argued with Jordan Sekulow. I always forget how to say his last name properly on Fox about this. So he may have, in theory, violated his employment agreement, but that at most, that's a breach of contract. There's no criminal aspect to that. So a lot of people are asking, could he be prosecuted for it? Well, so let's go through what he did. So he drafted personal memoranda to him for the record for himself. He did it on a government system. And as far as we understand, and this was never truly fleshed out sufficiently as far as I thought in the hearing, he brought at least a copy of it to home with himself. So he's got at least one copy of these memos. Whether or not he left a copy with the government, he should have. I'm certainly hoping he did, because that would be a concern from transparency side. But he should have left a copy with the FBI, but he kept a copy for himself. So then what are the criminal issues? Well, one is, okay, was there anything classified? You know, we dealt with Emailgate and Hillary Clinton with her private server and the classified information on the emails. So, okay, so did James Comey have any classified information in these memos? Well, one, as the FBI director, he would have been what's called an original classification authority. So he would have had the ability to deem the information classified or unclassified on his own. But putting that aside, given the nature and the substance of what's in these memos, there's no indication that any of it would have implicated classified information. So that's one issue. The separate one that keeps coming up is it's a provision of the U.S. code that no one knew about prior to this. It's called 18 U.S.C. 641, which is the conversion of property provision in the U.S. code. And what it's been argued by some is that by taking that memo and what people are considering an agency record and converting it into personal use to leak to the New York Times and then to give to the special counsel, that somehow Mr. Comey had violated that provision and was guilty of a crime. The problem is, one, that provision's never been applied with respect to pure information. It does reference the idea of any record being converted. So in theory, you could sit there and interpret it going, okay, well, this applies to any agency record. Well, okay, that's nice, but the courts have never applied it in any context where there wasn't some type of monetary value. It had to be worth something. The idea of it applying to pure information has never been something the courts have allowed. And the Justice Department's criminal division manual that's online and anybody can read it actually has a note in there that it's DOJ policy. They won't even bring a case under that provision, under this particular part of the U.S. code, if the person who took the information was now a private citizen and was doing it solely for the purpose of informing the public. They won't even bother bringing the case. So even if in some far stretch of interpretation you could make a case, it's simply not DOJ policy to pursue this anyways. So all there's no criminal aspect here. There's possible breaches of civil or ethical issues. You know, whether or not the former director, you know, breached executive privilege, okay, maybe you could refer him to the state bar if you wanted, get him disbarred. I think it'd be a stretch. And then there's a possibility of, okay, well, he released these memos without going through pre-publication review. Great. You can go ahead and take him to court in civil court. There's no damages because he didn't do it for money. He didn't write a book. He just gave it to the New York Times and eventually the special counsel. So you can get a court judgment that gets you nothing, which is why, you know, everybody can blow smoke all they want on this and have a bunch of political gnashing of their teeth. The director didn't violate any laws as far as I'm concerned.
Brad, the other issue that has come up is one of the question of executive privilege, and we heard this again with the Sessions testimony. Now, first, I think if we could perhaps briefly define what exactly is executive privilege, and then we can talk about, did Comey
violate executive privilege, or did Trump waive executive privilege with anything that he's done?
So the concept of executive privilege is just like any other, you know, evidentiary privilege you'd ever heard if you ever watched Law and Order or anything like that. It's like attorney-client privilege. It's the ability of the White House, of the executive branch, to protect documentation memorializing conversations between the president and any member of his government. So it's an, you know, it's a discussion between the president and the FBI director that would in theory implicate executive privilege, and the president would have the authority to invoke it. But it only really applies to conversations done by the president. It would not apply necessarily to conversations between Reince Priebus and the FBI director. It's a privilege that can be invoked only by the president.
So let me ask you this, because a lot of people are saying that Comey, you know, he leaked the contents of their conversation. But reality is Donald Trump was the first one to, you know, talk about their private conversations in the letter in which he terminated Comey. And he said, I'm glad you told me three times that I was not under investigation. So is it now? And again, this is a legal question. That I don't have any. Is executive privilege waived the moment that he sits there and talks about it, or can he still maintain that the conversations were, you know, covered by executive privilege and Comey wasn't allowed to say anything?
Yeah, no, the moment he starts making official statements like that, he has effectively waived executive privilege. So when he made that first tweet, wrote the letter firing Comey, and he talked about, oh, thank you for telling me three times I'm not under investigation, he's waived executive privilege on that fact. When he starts tweeting about other issues, when he starts talking about or responding to press reports and saying, I never asked for a loyalty oath and I never asked him to drop anything related to Michael Flynn, he's waiving aspects of the privilege and making it so that if he then tried to invoke it and prohibit Director Comey from talking about it, it would go to court as a civil action and the government would almost certainly lose the argument, which is why, honestly, they didn't bother trying to block Comey's testimony before the Intelligence Committee, because it would have been laughable. It wouldn't have gone very far.
Okay. All right. So moving on with that. So after Comey testified, we had, you know, well, prior to that, because Comey testified last week, but Robert Mueller, former FBI director, was appointed as special counsel last month. I think it was on May 17th when he was appointed as special counsel. Now, when he was appointed, pretty much everybody was in agreement that it was a great choice, that, you know, he's got an impeccable record, you know, for fairness, but toughness. Everybody, I mean, there was praise from all sides for Mueller's appointment as special counsel. Then Jim Comey testifies, and suddenly things change completely. Now, all of a sudden, you know, and I think anybody who's in D.C. would know or has been around the FBI or the Justice Department for the last 15 years would know that Jim Comey and Robert Mueller were friends. This is not a new revelation. But all of a sudden, they started pointing this out and then started saying, you know, well, that seems to be a conflict of interest. And then, of course, there was, you know, him hiring staff. And it turns out, you know, then people started accusing Mueller of hiring, quote unquote, Democratic donors to be a part of his staff. So when that comes up, the whole idea of a conflict of interest, is there any merit? And so people are clear, people are suggesting that Donald Trump should go ahead and fire Robert Mueller because of what they're saying is the quote unquote clear conflict of interest that Mueller has by being friends with Jim Comey. So is there any merit to the conflict of interest accusation?
Pretty much no, not much at all. This is a lot of political smoke. So let's be clear. A conflict of interest is the concept for a lawyer where, for due to any number of financial or professional connections that you have, cannot be trusted in the eyes of the state bar and in terms of from ethical considerations to represent the interests of the client properly and to handle your responsibilities objectively and impartially. And so, you know, it often comes up, you know, when people come in from the private sector to work for the federal government, they have to look back and do an ethics review of, okay, who were your old clients? Because if you represented Boeing in acquiring, you know, 20 airplanes last year, you can't be handling a prosecution of Boeing now that you work for the Justice Department. There's a clear conflict of interest, which would implicate your impartiality. So that's, you know, the obvious one of former clients. There's business ties. And this was something where they started bringing up, okay, well, they're friends. Comey and Mueller are friends. And my thought was, do they, are they co-signers on one of their each other's car loans? You know, did Comey lend Mueller money to buy a house? I mean, those would be theoretical financial conflicts of interest. But outside of that, the fact that they're friends, you know, whoop-de-doo, for lack of a better, you know, response, who cares? Everybody in this town eventually knows everybody if you stay here long enough, especially if you spend years upon years inside the Justice Department at senior levels. You're going to know other people. The concern is that they make sure that there's no professional or financial conflicts that would implicate Mueller's impartiality. There's been none shown that I've seen. The fact that Comey may have in his mind been aiming to try to make sure a special counsel was appointed after he got fired, that alone doesn't create a conflict of interest, because how did he know who Rod Rosenstein was going to pick? He didn't know that he'd pick Robert Mueller. He could have picked the guy off the street for all he knew. It could have been anybody. It didn't necessarily, it wasn't necessarily going to be Robert Mueller. So no, there's no legitimacy, and as far as I'm concerned, that there's some conflict of interest that requires the president trying to get president issuing an order saying that there's good cause to fire the special counsel.
Now, Brad, Trump's present difficulties arise from allegations of collusion with Russia on the part of his campaign or individuals in his transition team. But the president himself has not been implicated in any outright collusion. Nevertheless, it was it hit the news that President Trump is indeed under investigation for obstruction of justice. By the way, this happened on President Trump's birthday. Happy birthday, Mr. President. But the charge is obstruction of justice. Now, this is something that is something I don't necessarily understand. And I was hoping you could explain to me exactly what obstruction of justice is, and how the president can be investigated for it if he hasn't actually done anything wrong.
Absolutely. So the concept of obstruction of justice is when someone tries to corruptly impede, influence, or in any way apply pressure to an ongoing proceeding. And so as a matter of federal law, for instance, there are certain technical requirements that act of what was required to make an obstruction charge that would actually save the president if this ever had gotten to a criminal proceeding. For example, the courts have generally concluded that the mere existence of an investigation in and of itself does not satisfy the requirement that there be a pending proceeding. It has to have actually gotten beyond just an investigation. And there'd be questions about whether or not simply asking the former director to find his way to let Flynn go would be enough. And the great travesty, unfortunately, here for the Trump administration and for the Trump presidency is it's very possible. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if any collusion that may have occurred between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, if there was anything, I would not be surprised in the slightest if Donald Trump knows nothing about any of it. Given the way in which he manages, given his very 30,000 foot style way of overseeing his organization, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't have a clue about it. That doesn't mean other lower level people didn't do something, but he doesn't know anything about it. So he's sitting here thinking, why is there this worthless investigation going on? I know I didn't do anything. Well, that's great. But now that you've tried to impede and tried to, you know, thumb your nose at it and calling it a witch hunt, and you're firing the FBI director who's investigating it, you're bringing a separate procedural criminal liability upon yourself that would never have happened if you had just let it run its course. You know, and so like I was going back to what I was saying in terms of being the great travesty, the president probably could have survived this fine. He may have been politically scarred, depending on what comes out of the investigation, but he would have himself survived and gotten through his first term without any issues if he had just left it alone. But like Richard Nixon, he doesn't have the thick enough skin to just let the process run without him having to, you know, poke and prod into it, and he's getting himself into trouble and digging a hole by way of trying to influence how the process works. And when it comes to impeachment, obstruction can be whatever Congress decides it wants it to be. There are no real rules in impeachment. They're not bound by federal law.
Well, we want to get into impeachment in a minute and talk more about that. But before we do, now, with the caveat that you are not leading the investigation of President Trump's obstruction of justice charge, do you think there's a case to be made?
I think there's enough to be concerned. If I were the prosecutor, if I'm Robert Mueller looking at this, what I know just and what I just know from what's been publicly reported is enough to raise a concern in my mind that there's something of the way Director Comey described it, of investigative interest. It doesn't mean that I'm convinced there will be a case. It doesn't mean that there ultimately will be one that I'll decide to bring. But the fact that the president would have intervened like that and tried to get Director Comey to back off would be of concern. So what else do I want? Well, I want to see more evidence of intent, of corrupt intent by the president. So you consider other factors. We know that the loyalty pledge that Director Comey claims was demanded of him was given at a dinner the same day that then acting Attorney General Sally Yates informs the White House counsel that the Justice Department views Michael Flynn as exposed and subject to blackmail. Then he all of a sudden the president asks for loyalty from the FBI director. That's going to raise concerns. Okay, that's point number two. Point number three, we've got these reports, which we still haven't gotten verification or denial of one way or the other, that the president went to directors of the CIA, the NSA, the ODNI, all trying to get them to ask Director Comey to back off of Flynn. Now, these are multiple pieces now I've got of circumstantial evidence, and any obstruction case is going to be circumstantial evidence, but of circumstantial evidence that shows a possible corrupt intent. And that's just going to continue to lead me down this investigative path. So to answer your question in a very long-winded way, is there enough right now that I could believe I could make a case? I would be hesitant to do so. I think it's a little too circumstantial, a little too attenuated right now. But is there enough for me to look further into it? Absolutely.
And so yeah, I mean, we don't know, because those guys wouldn't really say what Donald Trump said to them. Talking about the intelligence community officials, you know, Rogers and Dan Coats, they kind of would not say in a public setting what President Trump said to them. So we don't know what they said in a private setting. Now, here's a question. Is Robert Mueller will he have access to what is Coats and Comey and Rogers have said to the Senate Senate committees in closed session? Will he have access to that information?
He can if he wants to, but he's not going to even need to, because he has the authority, and I believe he's actually meeting up with them later this week. He has the authority to depose all three of those individuals under oath.
Okay, gotcha. All right, good. That's interesting. Okay, so moving along to what Neil had said, we're talking about, you know, and you kind of brought it up briefly, was the whole idea of impeachment. And impeachment, like, as you were just saying, there doesn't necessarily need to be a criminal act in order for the president of the United States to be impeached. But somebody did bring up a good point. It was David Harsanyi of The Federalist said that he doesn't think Congress would have, you know, would I don't want to say the guts or anything like that, or he said the will, that's a better word, the will to engage in impeachment proceedings unless there was some kind of criminality involved. He thinks that you could sit there and take something that says abuse of power. So, yeah, they could make a case that when Donald Trump asked James Comey to back off, or when he fired him or something, it was an abuse of power. But how do you prove abuse of power? Whereas with obstruction of justice, like you said, if there's a criminal element to it, then they could sit there and say, OK, Robert Mueller said this. Now, as such, we see it as this. I mean, do you see it that way, or do you think that impeachment is a partisan process? It is a political process. So if Democrats were to take control of Congress in 2018, do you think they're going to impeach regardless, kind of the way the Republicans did with Bill Clinton? Or do you think, you know, it may get to a point where even Republicans may have to sit there and say, okay, this is serious, you know, kind of give us what your overview of it, what you think?
Sure, absolutely. No, I think the gentleman from The Federalist is pretty much right in the sense that while it's ultimately, impeachment's a purely political process. And so in theory, they could try to impeach this president or any president for the vague idea of abuse of power. They're not going to want to put their own political careers at risk for that. They're going to want something that they can sell to the public in a concrete and understandable way. And so that's why I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if it ever comes to that point, I'm not convinced yet it will get there. Because again, it's all about political will. And unless the Democrats take back at least one of the chambers of Congress, I don't necessarily see Republicans going down this path. I think they view it as if they were to do so, they would just give up. They're basically surrendering their majority, whether it's 2018 or 2020, that they'd be just throwing it all and, you know, throwing in the towel, that they have to stick with Trump one way or the other to survive, at least for the moment. So unless the Democrats take back one of the chambers or both, it's not going to happen. But if they do, even if they were to take back the House and or the Senate, they're going to want to have a concrete legal argument, particularly along the lines of obstruction, that they can package and sell to the public. And they're going to want to make it so that it doesn't look like what ultimately came out of the Clinton impeachment, where in the end, yeah, everybody understood that what Clinton did looked pretty shady. Everyone understood that he had danced right along the lines of potential perjury. But in the end, people just came to view the entire process as overly politicized, overly partisan, and not really a productive use of the government's time. And Republicans suffered for it in the 98 midterms, when they honestly should have been gaining considerable number of seats in an off-year election. And instead, they get, as far as I recall, if they gained anything, it was minimal. And so if you're Paul Ryan and you're Mitch McConnell, if you're Nancy Pelosi and you're Chuck Schumer, if you take back Congress, the last thing you want to do is then give it all up with an overly partisan impeachment that the public just won't accept.
Right. And okay, so we just, so we're clear, there doesn't need to be criminality in order for Congress to impeach a president, but it probably would be, especially for Republicans and then even Democrats who would be emboldened, if Robert Mueller came back and said, you know, that's the whole thing, though. Now, this is a different question. Robert Mueller has, from what I understand, has prosecutorial authority in his role as special counsel. So correct. He can go to a grand jury and he can get somebody indicted. I mean, and I don't know this, and maybe you do, or maybe Neil does, has a sitting president ever been indicted for a crime?
No, and it's an untested legal theory if a sitting president could be indicted for a crime, especially for actions that he undertook while serving in the office of the president, which is why if it ever got to that point, if Robert Mueller finishes his investigation and he believes there's sufficient evidence of obstruction of justice by the president, he'll refer that to Congress to address in a purely political context.
Okay. So then, all right. So then he goes and he issues a report or something that says, yes, there's enough evidence here to show that in a criminal court, I could convict him of obstruction of justice. And that would certainly trigger, I would imagine, impeachment proceedings pretty much immediately,
you would think so, but in the current political climate, you know what, no one truly knows what would happen, because again, you know, you have to think about it. So if, you know, let's say Mueller were to issue his report in 9 months, if you're Paul Ryan, do you really want to take this up in the House? Do you really want to put your majority on the line like that? You know, you have to balance the different political considerations. And to go back to the other part of the question, no, Congress can make up, can essentially impeach someone and then convict them in the Senate based on something that's not a quote unquote crime. They can make whatever is high crimes and misdemeanors is whatever Congress wants it to be. That was the way the framers set it up, for better or for worse. They get to set their own rules in this context, but they then have to be accountable to the public through elections. So if there ever is an impeachment proceeding, they're going to want it to be as ironclad as they want to avoid repeating the mistakes of the Republicans in the 90s.
Okay.
Okay, Brad, one final question for you before we move into our gotcha. If Donald Trump called you tomorrow and said, Mr. Moss, I need representation, I need legal advice, what is the one key piece of advice that you would give President Donald Trump going forward?
Get off Twitter.
That is very sound advice.
There you go. There you go.
For the love of everything that is holy, get off Twitter, get off Facebook, stop talking about this, because every time he does that, he is just adding to the various legal cases against him. Not necessarily just in the context of this special counsel investigation. I mean, all the cases, all the litigation over the travel ban, the ACLU is just quoting his tweets left and right. I have a couple pieces of FOIA litigation coming up where I'm going to be quoting his tweets in terms of whether or not he's officially confirmed the existence of certain classified information. I mean, he's bearing.
All right. So, Brad, for one last thing, is there anything that you've read, anything going on within the bounds of Donald Trump and the investigation, anything that's a legal issue that you see every day and you shake your head and say, no, that's wrong. And that seems to be a consensus point of view for one side or the other on a legal matter that you know is just not accurate? And it's okay if you don't think of anything. I mean, that means we've just covered everything.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, there's a lot of things where I would say from a policy standpoint, I'm shaking my head, or a tradition custom standpoint, I'm shaking my head. But when it comes to the authority of the federal government, when it comes to the authority of the president in particular, there's a lot of nuance and gray areas. And so it's hard to ever say for a lot of these things that, no, that's clearly wrong, because nothing's ever truly clear with the authority of the executive branch. It very much swings back and forth. And so anyone who ever tells you, I can say with complete and unequivocal certainty that XYZ act was unlawful, is selling you something, because no one ever truly knows until the nine justices rule on it. That's about the extent of someone truly knowing.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, Brad, thanks so much for joining us. Before we let you go, we do have one last order of business. Neil, let's bring him in. Let's set him up for this gotcha question.
All right, Brad, we're about to drop a bomb on you.
Oh, go ahead.
I hope you're ready.
You've got an ex-girlfriend on the line, don't you?
No, the situation is much more dire than that, sir. I'm afraid that we are going to present you with a question. The answer to which Jay and I disagree upon fundamentally, on a deep level, we disagree on this issue, and we turn to you in your wisdom to help us find the way forward. The question before you, Brad Moss, is, which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Ooh. I'm going to go with the Beatles, sir.
Brad, that's a fine choice.
That was very difficult to make, though.
No satisfaction for me,
I guess. See? Perfect song there, Neil. So, all right. Yeah. So we.
Let it be, Neil. Let it be.
Yeah, you. There it is. Neil, you may need some shelter. Go ahead and tell somebody to give you shelter. This is great. Brad, this was actually a new question. We had been on something else for quite a while. So you were the test for this new question. And I must say that it was very successful in my view.
Now watch, the next 10 people you guys have are all going to go for Neil.
Well, that's what he hopes.
Not historically.
Historically, it hasn't been that way. But who knows? Maybe he'll win one here. So Brad Moss, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you bringing your expertise here and kind of letting our audience know about all these issues. It was really informative.
Absolutely. Happy to help anytime, guys.
All right. That's Brad Moss from the Mark, what is it? I forgot how to say it again.
The Law Office of Mark S. Zade.
Super Zade Law Firm.
There we go. I'm going to get a change to that.
So, Mark, thanks again. Neil, so Good episode. That was fun, right?
Oh, I had a blast, and yeah. I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners did too.
Hopefully, and if you like this episode, if you appreciated it, if you had fun, if you thought it was informative, please, like I said before, go out there, leave a rating on iTunes, subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe. We are we're adding subscribers, and we're enjoying it, and more people are listening, so that's a lot of fun. So that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. For Neil Dewing, I'm Jay Caruso, and we will see you next time. Fifth Estate. While you see it your way, there's a chance that we might fall.